uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. But can we remain the greatest nation on God's green earth if we remain so bitterly, so incurably, it would seem, divided? There is a provocative column by Ed Kilgore that appeared in New York Magazine. And the title, "We Are Two Nations, Divisible." Is he actually talking about part of the nation seceding from the other, actually splitting the nation down the middle? No, it's not like that, because even within given geographic areas, the divisions are profound. So what is the answer? Ed Kilgore suggests in his column that the answer is, we may be destined in the very near future to acknowledge and resolve our differences by choosing sides and having it out. Is that what they're doing down in Texas right now, or with the runaway Dems in the nation's capital? Ed Kilgore is a veteran Democratic Party wonk. He is a political analyst and a Georgia expat, he says. He's also a political columnist for New York Magazine. Ed, great to meet you on the phone, and thanks for joining us on the show.
Glad to be here.
Okay, when you talk about having it out as a way of settling our differences, what's an example of how that would work?
Well, it would mean, most notably, one party achieving a definitive election victory, obtaining the levers of real power in Washington and in many of the states, and, you know, producing a record that can, for which they can then be held accountable. What I was really talking about in the column is I was pushing back at this idea that our divisions are sort of artificial, that they've been created by, you know, rancorous news media or professional politicians, and that, you know, we really just all want to get along, cut deals, and, you know, not worry about it too much. And I just think there's a lot of evidence that we're at one of these moments in history, and there have been others, in which there are profound differences that need to be worked out through political conflict, not armed conflict. And, you know, just as the nation had to choose between slavery and emancipation, between, you know, sort of a New Deal activism in the middle of the 20th century and a laissez-faire philosophy, we may be at another one of those inflection points in which we really do have to choose. And that means through peaceful political competition, not violence. But it does mean acknowledging our differences instead of pretending they don't exist or minimizing.
As pretending they don't exist is one thing, but putting them in context, it seems to me to be another. First of all, the kind of sweeping election victory that you're talking about, I guess the last time you could say that there was a electoral result that was comparable to that was 2008 with Obama's first victory, but that didn't seem to settle things in terms of the bitter fights in which we were all engaged. And in fact, the Republicans took back the House of Representatives right after that victory. Doesn't that speak to how difficult it is to settle things?
Oh yes. Yes, I don't doubt for a moment that it's difficult, and you're right that at the time, it's certainly to us Democrats, it looked like a, you know, a watershed sort of victory. Though frankly, anything that produces fewer than 60 senators, and Democrats only briefly had that landmark in 2009, makes, you know, kind of unilateral governing difficult, as we're seeing right now, as a matter of fact. But you know, I think part of the process here is for Americans generally to realize that this sort of back and forth between the two parties, particularly in presidential and midterm elections, where it appears that portions of the electorate, at least, are trying to, you know, maintain a balance so that no one party has too much power, can be horribly destructive over time. Because it does sort of eliminate any real accountability if you know you can't really govern if you have a majority, and you know you don't need to if you're in the minority. So, you know, this is really aimed not at just elites, but at those kind of Americans, and I talk to them every day, well-meaning Americans who really do mistrust politics so much that they really don't want anybody to achieve any lasting power. And
well,
that can be very destructive.
Given the hysteria we're going through today about the voting reforms in Texas, which, honest to God, I mean, I've actually tried to read the legislation and to take a look at specifically what is being called for here. Do I think that every reform that is being put forward by the state's Republicans is a good idea? No, some of it's stupid. But do I believe that this is the worst assault on democracy, as President Biden just said, since the Civil War? Isn't there a tendency of people to exaggerate issues that could be easily compromised? Easily compromised. For instance, gun regulation. It's not all take away all the guns, or there is no right to regulate guns at all. There's a whole range of middle ground, isn't there?
In theory, there is, but as I think I pointed out in my piece, totally aside from the differences between the two parties, the differences between ideological tendencies are growing more serious, too. The thing that's really remarkable to me on the gun issue is how many conservatives have become what I call Second Amendment absolutists, treating it, dispensing with the idea of even any sort of gun licensing for any purposes whatsoever, and in some cases holding that the right to bear arms is intended to make it possible to overthrow the government when some people think we need it. So, yes, you've identified an area where there should, in theory, be compromises available, but whenever compromises have appeared in Congress, notably the Manchin Toomey proposal on gun show loopholes, they were filibustered.
Okay, when you talk about basically admitting that we have deep differences and then settling them, isn't part of the problem here that, as we were talking about before, our elections have not really been that definitive. Even the Obama race that we were talking about, the 2008 race, President Obama got 53%. That's not quite a landslide, though in modern terms, recent terms, it has been. Joe Biden was speaking earlier today before he talked about the Jim Crow 2.0, as he claimed, about building new coalitions. That also seems to have been a fantasy that a lot of recent presidents have tried to advance without much success. Ed Kilgore does a good job of framing the issue, but very much in the spirit of his piece is called We Are Two Nations Divisible. We will post it up at our website at michaelmedved.com. I think frames the issue very effectively. Ed, I appreciate your joining us, and I hope you can come on the show again. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the California recall, where this is an extraordinary thing. The nation's largest state, a state with 40 million people, is moving into an election where it is entirely possible, and if you read the polling, it's not unthinkable, that the governor will be removed more than a full year before the end of the term to which he was elected. There's a question of whether or not Gavin Newsom actually deserves that kind of treatment, but he may get it. And he has a formidable new candidate against him who's getting in just under the deadline. His name is Larry Elder. We'll be speaking with him and more coming up on The MedVed Show, 1-800-955-1776.
Your outlet for outrage.
It is outrageous what you are saying.
The Michael MedVed Show.
This is outrageous.
We'll be right back.
On the Michael Medved show, government statements, especially today in today's environment, government statements from health departments are often ignored or mocked or not taken to heart. But there was a statement released by the Department of Health for the Republic of South Africa. And it made the rounds on the internet. It has been shared and embraced, apparently, millions of times. And it's a brief document, so I can read it to you in its entirety. And you can please do take it with a grain of salt. Not every government document that is issued on the internet and circulates millions of times is necessarily something you should take home. But if you choose to, well, it's up to you. The statement by the Department of Health says the only way we can beat this coronavirus is that let's keep everyone indoors at least 4 to 6 hours every day. And we confirm that sex is the only medication we can use for now. Let's try to make many rounds as we can, at least 4 to 5 per day, until further notice. This is for elders only, in good health and strong. Together we conquer. And it has an official looking mark on it. It has been exposed as a fraud, a fake government document claiming sex could cure COVID-19 has been debunked by South Africa's National Health Department. Even though the poorly written official government report marked with the official health department logo was riddled with spelling mistakes and factual errors, it was shared very widely on social media. Well, of course.
Hot dog.
This is what the announcement I've been waiting for. Right. The fake document actually has no action has been taken about it, except maybe by some people who choose to take it seriously. And while that fake document is making its rounds, there's continued talk about the much less titillating subject of voting reform in Texas. This is what Jen Psaki, the president's press secretary, said in introducing the speech that he just gave the National Constitution Center, in which he proclaimed that we are facing the worst challenge to our...
He'll also decry efforts to strip the right to vote as authoritarian and anti-American, and stand up against the notion that politicians should be allowed to choose their voters or to subvert our system by replacing independent election authorities with partisan ones. And he will highlight the work of the administration against this, the necessity of passing the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, and how we need to work together with civil rights organizations to build as broad a turnout and voter education system to overcome the worst challenge to our democracy since the Civil War. So this is an opportunity for him to make the case to the American people about how this is a fundamental right.
Okay, the worst challenge to our democracy since the Civil War. If anybody agrees with that, please explain. 1-800-955-1776. Chuck Schumer tried to explain on the Senate floor. He had this to say, and it's extraordinary because it seems to echo some of what we've been hearing from President Trump. This is clip 14.
No right is more sacred than the right to vote. And yet, across the country, Republican-controlled state legislatures are conducting the most sweeping and coordinated attack on voting rights in generations, fueled by Donald Trump's insidious big lie that the election was stolen. In several states, limits have been placed on voting hours, polling locations, and methods of voting. Barriers have been raised to make voting by mail, absentee voting, and after-hours voting, and early voting harder. Republican legislatures are not only making it harder to vote, they're making it easier to steal an election.
Okay, when he says they're making it easier to steal an election, Who is Mr. Steal the Election? Well, it's all that Trump talks about, basically. And is he trying to set up Chuck Schumer, the Democrats, so that if they don't do well, and I frankly don't think they will, if they don't do well in the election of 2022, which is still a long way away, that they would be set up to say that this election was stolen, that this has to be reviewed and reneged? Let me just give you some sense of what we really are talking about here, beyond all the hyperbole and the apocalyptic language about the worst threat to democracy since the Civil War. Some Democrats, the New York Times summarizes, hope that presidential attention will persuade Congress to pass a voting rights bill that outlaws the new Republican voting rules. But that's unlikely. Congressional Republicans are uniformly opposed to ambitious voting rights bills. And some Senate Democrats, including Joe Manchin, seem unwilling to change the filibuster, which would almost certainly be necessary to pass a bill. So why is Biden giving a speech? In part, it helps him avoid criticism from progressive Democrats that he is ignoring the subject they love. But Biden also appears to be genuinely concerned about the issue, and the use of the presidential bully pulpit is one of the few options available to him. Over the long term, high-profile attention may increase the chances of federal legislation. In Texas, Democratic legislatures fled the state to deny the Republican-controlled legislature the quorum it needs to pass a restrictive voting bill. The move is likely only to delay the bill, not stop it from becoming law. That writes the New York Times. And then they summarize. In 17 states, Republican lawmakers have recently enacted laws limiting ballot access. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, Texas would become the 18th. So far, at least 14 states have enacted laws that give partisan officials more control over election oversight, potentially allowing those politicians to overturn an election result, as Donald Trump urged state-level Republicans to do last year. That, it seems to me, that aspect of giving partisan, but it's not partisan to one party. If you are giving that kind of power to one side or another, it's supposed to be bipartisan. In Georgia, a Republican-controlled commission now has the power to remove local election officials and has already removed some. Arkansas has empowered a state board to take over and conduct elections in a county if the GOP-dominated legislature deems it necessary. Arizona Republicans took away the Democratic Secretary of State's authority over election lawsuits and gave it to the Republican Attorney General. Both positions are elected statewide. Some of the new laws, it says, restrict early voting. Iowa, for example, has shortened the early voting period of 20 days to 20 days from 29 and reduced poll hours on Election Day. Is reducing poll hours on Election Day or having fewer days of early voting, does that really constitute a profound threat to the Republic? There's a recall going on in California. New candidate. And on the Michael Medved Show, we've just posted up at our website a tweet from Larry Elder. And actually, it's from electelder.com. Why Elect Elder? Because Larry, who is, of course, a beloved institution in the world of talk radio, particularly in Southern California, but really all around the country, Larry has a photo of himself, masked, by the way, properly signing papers at the L.A. County Registrar of Voters in Norwalk. And he says, I am now officially a candidate for governor in the recall election on September 14th. First of all, Larry, congratulations. Must be an exciting day.
It's an insane day, a crazy day. Michael, you've known me a long time. Have you ever, ever, ever heard me say I want to enter the world of politics?
No, Prager talks about that, but you haven't. And
no.
When I was thinking about this, this election is so wide open and it's so unpredictable. And what a great opportunity to get your message out. So let's get right to that. First of all, what are the best reasons that voters in California should vote to throw out Gavin Newsom?
Where do you start? I think you start with the arrogant way he ignored science and imposed the harshest coronavirus lockdowns than any of the 50 states. This is a man who kept his own kids in-person private education, exempted his own business, a winery, from the very mandates he imposed on everybody else. And then he sat at that French Laundry restaurant. Michael, I hadn't even heard of that restaurant until he ate there, and I found out it's not one of the most shishi restaurants in California. It's one of the most shishi restaurants in the country. And the tab was more than $12,000. I heard it was closer to $30,000. But the point is, he's sitting there violating the mask mandates, violating the social distancing mandates with the very lobbyists and medical professionals who drafted them while shutting down everybody else's business. Two-thirds of jobs have been recovered outside of California. Only half of the jobs have been recovered inside of California. The damage that this man did is incalculable. We don't even know how many businesses are bankrupt because the bankruptcy courts are only beginning now to open up. All I know, it's been a disaster, and the point is he's done this against the science. The science said that you could have in-school learning with precautions. The teachers didn't want to do that. They were still being paid. The biggest lobbyists, the biggest contributors to his campaign are the teachers' unions, and he did their bidding to the detriment of kids in this state. Nearly 80% of the kids educated K through 12 in public schools in California are black and brown. They're already getting a lousy education in the urban setting. 75% of black kids in this state cannot read at state levels of proficiency. Nearly half of all kids cannot read at state levels of proficiency, and they lost a whole year of in-school learning. It is an absolute assault on the path to the middle class, and I think maybe, just maybe, I might be able to do something as a product of the very public school system that I'm talking about.
Well, good for you. And one thing that I think you can help to clarify here, there are a lot of people I know who sort of shrug their shoulders and say, oh, this is just splits the Republican vote. The way this crazy election works, it doesn't. It adds to the anti-Newsom vote. In other words, first of all, before any Republican or any alternative to Newsom even gets considered, you have to get a majority of votes, putting together from all the candidates a majority of votes of people who say no Newsom. And then they can choose between you and the 2,000 other people who are on the ballot. You're now clearly one of the leading candidates. Why should people pick Larry Elder above any of the other candidates?
Well, I've been talking about the issues of limited government, low taxes, light regulation, and choice in school for decades. I'm on in Sacramento. I'm on in the Bay Area. I'm on in the center of the state. I'm on in Ventura. I'm on, of course, in L.A. I'm on in Riverside, in San Diego. So I have higher name recognition than any of the candidates, with the exception of Caitlyn Jenner. And I think I can explain to Joe and Joe and Six Pack there's a connection between the high crime and stupid policies coming out of Sacramento. There's a connection between the high cost of living and the anti-building narrative that has been pushed by the environmental extremists. I can make connection between the rise in homelessness and the feckless poor policies that are promoting it. What Governor Gavin Newsom has done is to argue that we ought to build more housing. I think we've spent so far $12 billion, quote, building more housing. When you haven't dealt with the underlying reason why people are homeless in the first place, building more housing doesn't do any good. If you could get them to get in it, they won't stay. And what happens is people from the other 49 states come to California and say, I can get a free house and there's no snow, I'm coming to California. Cops tell me that a large number of people on Skid Row aren't even from here because essentially we're encouraging slovenly behavior and therefore getting more and more of it. The people who are on the streets need to be dealt with care and compassion, and we need to get the churches involved in it. Pastor Jack Hibbs of the Calgary Church has told me, let us handle this. We know how to turn around people's lives. We know how to do this far better with greater compassion, greater efficiency, and less cost than what we're doing right now.
Okay, other than what you're talking about, getting the churches involved, what can a governor do on this homeless issue, which is so critical, but it's mostly a local issue, isn't it?
No, well, local in the sense that it's in the big cities. Well, what the government can do, what a governor can do, is declare a national emergency. One of the reasons for the homeless is because we don't have cheap apartments, we don't have low-cost housing in California because of, as I mentioned, because of the extremists that believe when you put a spoon in the ground, it has a negative environmental impact. Because of CEQA, that's an acronym for the California Environmental Control Act, virtually anybody can stop any construction for any reason. So even after you make the homeless people self-sufficient, where are they going to live? Because they won't be able to find a cheap apartment. They won't be able to find cheap housing. I believe, and I talked with one of the lawyers for the last Republican governors we had, Pete Wilson, and he said, you'd be amazed at your ability to declare a statewide emergency and suspend some of these anti-construction laws to spur the development on the private sector to build some of these homes.
If you are elected governor, if you're the next governor, you'd have, about a year and a half in that term. What would be your number one immediate priority?
The number one priority would be crime. Right now, the law is that if you steal $950 or less, you get a misdemeanor. You get a ticket if you're caught. There's no threat of going to jail. When the voters foolishly passed Proposition 47, which implemented that, the idea was that instead of putting people in jail, we'll put them in drug rehab, alcohol rehab. Well, what's happened is you take away the threat of somebody going to jail. How are you going to say, okay, either you go to rehab or you go to jail, when in fact you go to rehab or nothing happens? And so you're having the phenomenon of people stealing $950 or less every single day without any fear of being forced to go to rehab and without fear of being forced to go to jail. It's been an absolute disaster, and the very voters who voted for it now realize what they did, and I would want to repeal that law. I've talked to a lot of sheriffs, a lot of police officers, and that's their number one outrage, Proposition 47. And then rhetorically, you don't find any defense of the cops coming out of Gavin Newsom. You have police that are demoralized because they're falsely accused of systemic racism. And much of police activity, as you know, is discretionary. So if I'm driving around and I'm a cop and I see something that looks suspicious, why should I get out of the car and put my butt on the line and possibly be accused of engaging in systemic racism? So what the police officers are doing are responding to radio calls. Bad guys know that crime goes up. When you remove the possibility of a criminal being caught, being convicted, and being incarcerated, it's no surprise that crime is going up, and that's what's happening in this state.
Well, this is all very exciting stuff. I'll tell you one thing that is a big argument for Larry Elder here is it would be such a pleasure to hear you debating Gavin Newsom. But, well, of course, that's probably
happen,
unlikely.
Michael.
That's
Michael,
probably
remember,
unlikely.
Remember that wonderful show that William F. Buckley had called Firing Line? He had it for 32 years. And on the last day, somebody said, Mr. Buckley, why is it that Ted Kennedy in 30 years has not accepted any of your invitation to come on your show? And Buckley said, why does the baloney avoid the grinder? This man's not going to debate me. I hope he does. If he gets scared enough, maybe he will. But I doubt that he'll do that.
Listen, Godspeed to you, my friend, and congratulations on this big day and to making your voice an even more substantive contributor to our public discourse. Go to electelder.com. You can go to electelder.com. We'll put a link right on our website at michaelmedved.com, and we will be right back.
There's a time where someone from the outside has to step in and take control.
Michael Medved.
Michael Medved Show. It's great to hear Larry, who's obviously charged up, Larry Elder, who's been a friend for many years and who is now a candidate. He is going to be on the ballot. He signed in fully. He is joining it's at least 14 other Republicans who are going to be appearing on the ballot. Of course, Caitlyn Jenner is probably the best known of them. And we've had on this radio show, I think three times, Kevin Faulkner, who is a two-term mayor of San Diego, who's also an excellent candidate. And the reason I'm mentioning this is, look, for those of you out there who are impressed by Mayor Faulkner, and then support him and go out and vote for him, But first, of course, you have to vote before you can vote for a Kevin Faulkner, before you can vote for a Larry Elder. You have to vote no on Gavin Newsom. You have to vote no on opening up the seat that everybody else is running for, which is why, frankly, Larry Elder's candidacy is very good news for Caitlyn Jenner. It's good news for Kevin Faulkner. It's good news for John Cox, who is one of the Republicans running. Because if you need to put all of those votes together, get a majority, and then whoever has the most of the Republican votes will be the next governor and have a good shot at holding the office, one would think, if that new governor does an excellent job. When the election comes, the regularly scheduled election, which is not September 14th this year, it's the regular election is November of next year, of 2022. But it is a fascinating race, and lots of color, and lots of color. I'm talking about the bear who has been campaigning together with John Cox, and of course PETA's complained about that. But this all in the California recall. You can find out more about it. There'll be material posted up at michaelmedved.com. Now, speaking at about some of the ongoing elections that are happening this year, we've indicated before that it does appear that Eric Adams is going to be the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York. He has won the primary, but and that means that he's very likely to win the general election. He was at the White House with President Biden as a police captain for many years. And as the Democratic nominee for mayor in New York, he was together with Biden and other local officials talking about the violence problem that is spreading around the country. And he said this about the president. This is clip 16, right as he was leaving. Listen.
We spent too much time looking at the role the police play. And as a former police officer, as a former, as you say, Republican, as a current Democrat, as a former person who was arrested and beat by police officers, I'm so many formers, I'm trying to figure out the current. One thing I'm clear about, the prerequisite to prosperity is public safety and justice. And if we don't have them both together, it doesn't matter how many police officers you put on the streets. We can't continue to respond to symptoms. It's time to respond to the underlying causes of violence in our city. This president is making it clear he's going to redefine the ecosystem of public safety, and that includes identifying the role of police, schools, families, resources, employment. This is where we need to go as a country.
Okay, but there, before you have those sweeping changes to family and employment and schools, what about putting more police out on the beat? And I believe that when he is mayor, assuming that he will be, Eric Adams would be sympathetic to that call for more policing. There's also another liberal who actually is part of a report that I think also shows a recognition of something that most conservatives have known for a very, very long time. It's a surprisingly honest report from CBS Evening News and Nora O'Donnell and correspondent Manuel Bojorquez, who talk about the unrest that continues in the island nation of Cuba. This is clip 9.
And tonight, President Biden says the U.S. stands with the Cuban people after the largest and most violent protests in decades against that country's communist regime. And they're the first since the Castro brothers relinquished power.
The protests are as remarkable as the outward displays of anger towards the government. Flipping over a police car here, the regime's response was swift. violent confrontations with police were posted online until the government cut the internet off. Thousands in Miami have joined in solidarity. President Joe Biden weighed in today.
Cuban people demanding their freedom from an authoritarian regime. And I don't think we've seen anything like this protest. In a long time.
Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel blamed the protest on a U.S.-backed social media campaign. Manipulating the emotions and feelings of people, he said. He blamed the economic downturn here on the U.S. embargo. But for many, the tipping points after six decades of communist rule are shortages of food and medicine exacerbated by the pandemic.
After six decades of communist rule. Yeah, that's what this is a demonstration against. It's not just the shortages of getting vaccines. There's also a talk about a new inclusion of the in the infrastructure bill. And of course, who's pushing for that new inclusion in the infrastructure bill, which may or may not ever get done? I think that the current bitterness over election reform is making it less likely that there's any progress on infrastructure. But Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaks up with a new idea for a bill that is already sweeping and incredibly expensive, a new and, she believes, transformational idea. Here is AOC.
You know, we have many, there's many, many different actions that we need in a climate bill for reconciliation, whether it's a civilian climate corps, whether it is increased infrastructure and investment in rail and mass transit, and whether it's also centering frontline indigenous, black and brown and low-income communities that are polluted on and often experience the greatest brunt of, and will be experiencing the greatest brunt of climate change related infrastructure failures.
Okay, the new idea here, it's something President Biden has talked about also, is a civilian climate corps. And that would be, and she says it would center on frontline indigenous, black and brown and low-income communities. The whole idea, it's based on the Civilian Conservation Corps that was part of FDR's New Deal at the height of the Depression. And what the CCC did is it took mostly young people, and it appealed to young people, and put them to work, for instance, building lodges and campgrounds and trails in our national forests and our national parks. And in fact, some of those buildings still stand and still serve, and it was a very popular program, and it helped a lot of young people get jobs at a time when they couldn't possibly get them. It's a peculiar thing to be talking about a civilian conservation corps. She calls it a climate corps. At a time like this, where there is a labor shortage. In other words, it is no longer 1934, 1935, where there were literally millions and millions of unemployed who couldn't get work anywhere, who couldn't earn anything. And so the government became an employer of last resort. It's also much more likely that any Biden-authorized civilian climate corps would involve boondoggles and fairly meaningless contributions to the issue of climate or conservation. The one thing that could be very encouraging here, and there have been several articles about it, there's something that, we can do and we can even concentrate on, and it should be the work of local governments, perhaps supported and encouraged by the federal government, planting trees. Because there is no question that planting trees, first of all, if you do reforestation, then you can prevent some of the devastating impact of wildfires. And the more trees you have, the more that it absorbs the carbon dioxide, which is supposed to be what is behind, according to method theory, the entire climate change challenge. It also makes cities more livable. And so why not? But of course, they won't give you any sense of that specificity for the future of this greatest nation on God's green earth.